The views and opinions expressed on America's Workforce Union podcast and its digital media channels are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of the producers or sponsors.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
The victims in the Baltimore bridge collapse and the response from the federal government. Nurses rally in California, the issue, access to health care. And today on the show, the government affairs director of the AFL-CIO and Labor's Local 596 in the state of Massachusetts. Welcome to the Thursday, March 28th edition of America's Workforce, where we're available on at least five platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. Bill Samuel will be our first guest on the show today. Bill serves as Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. That's the national organization out of Washington, AFLCIO.org. And if you've been listening to Bill's comments over the last couple of months, he, like many, have been very frustrated with Congress and the fact that they just haven't been getting anything done. They did avert the fourth shutdown threat. This happened just a week ago, and they finally agreed on a package of spending bills, which will last through the end of the fiscal year. Now, the fiscal year is not December 31st. It's September 30th. So we're already halfway there. So what's left on the agenda? Not very much. We will talk budget, though. Joe Biden's proposed federal budget for next year, which starts October 1, raises taxes on corporations and the rich, while, among other priorities, expands federal power to cut prescription drug prices. It would also add tax credits for the poor and the middle class. We'll touch on that. We'll get into some specifics. We're going to zero in on OSHA. There will be more money for OSHA and the National Labor Relations Board. We're talking about $655 million for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which is slightly more than in the year that began last October. OSHA would be able to hire 18 more workers, raising its workforce to just shy of 1,980, which actually is 100 fewer than in 2023. We'll also talk about what the other side is proposing, the Republicans, on their budget. And number one, it's cuts to Social Security and Medicare. They want to raise the retirement age, which essentially is a cut, and also reduce benefits, and also turn Medicare into a voucher system. So you get X amount of money for health care. When it runs out, you're out of luck. House Education and Workforce Committee Chair Virginia Fox, I always monitor what she's doing. She has sent a letter to 12 unions asking about fraud allegations that this committee uncovered. This is an interesting story. I can't wait to hear what Bill has to say about this one. She is a stick in the mud for organized labor. She cannot stand unions, and she's doing everything to suppress them. Chelsea Fenton will be our second guest on the show today, and she is the Executive Board Recording Secretary, Labor Steward, Journeyman Laborer for Local 596 in the state of Massachusetts. The website is Labor's Local 596.org. Massachusetts is a very union-friendly state. There are 20 locals in their district council, 20 locals, and 596 is just one of them. She's going to tell us her story. She found out about the labor's union after her dad came to her with the business card for a business agent at the time. So she went down to the union hall, applied. They said no. So she went back. When she turned 19, she applied again. They said no. Finally, this is a great story. Chelsea ended up harassing the business agent every week and waiting at the local for him to show up in the morning. And she said, you know what? You're going to give me this job because I'm going to work circles around you guys. And I need a good career with benefits. And they finally said, okay, okay, Chelsea, you can come on board. So fast forward, I mean, look what she turned into. Executive Board Recording Secretary, Labor Steward, Journeyman Labor. And she's also getting together a grassroots network for women in construction called Western Mass Tradeswomen, where they're connecting women to tradeswomen in the field. Also, she does volunteer work. I'll tell you, she is a woman on the move, no doubt about that. And we'll talk about how they're using social media to attract more people of color, more diverse workforce, which is what pretty much all the trades are doing right now. So Chelsea Fenton, Labor's Local 596, will be our second guest on the show. Now, a brief look into the world of labor. The segment brought to you by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, $17 billion in assets under advisement. The six victims of the Baltimore bridge collapse on Tuesday all appear to be construction workers from Latin American countries. This according to reports, including Miguel Luna, father of three, from El Salvador. Since the container ship Dolly crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge after losing power Tuesday morning, six members of a construction crew were filling potholes. And that's the time to do it because there's no traffic that early in the morning. Well, two bodies have been recovered out of the six. The immigrant services nonprofit We Are Casa confirmed that Luna, 49, had lived in Maryland for at least 19 years. Gustavo Torres, executive director of that organization, said he's a husband, father of three. He called Maryland his home for over 19 years. His son Marvin told the Washington Post he knew his father was on the bridge, but he had not heard of the tragedy until friends called him. Jesus Campos, a construction worker, said he knew the missing crew members, and they were all from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico. And he said, it's a very difficult situation. My friends were working on that bridge. Campo said the men all worked for the construction company Brawner Builders, where he himself had worked for 8 months, including on the overnight shift, until he was transferred to daytime hours 1 month ago. He said the workers were low-income immigrants who used their wages to support family members in the U.S. and abroad. By the way, that company, Brawner Builders, is based in Baltimore County, and they are a non-union shop. In fact, they are associated with ABC, Associated Builders and Contractors. When it comes to responding to the situation, got to do a salute here to the White House and their team there. They were out in front of this much faster than what happened in East Palestine, Ohio. 6 a.m. Tuesday morning, the National Transportation Safety Board already had a team of 24 people on the scene to launch an investigation into the cause of the collision. And there was a news conference on it last night, and they pointed out that ship, which is still tangled up with the bridge on top of it, was carrying hazardous cargo, something like 764 tons of hazardous cargo. Again, this investigation is going to take a lot of time here, a lot of time, and we promise to stay on it here and hopefully talk to all the unions that will be involved in rebuilding that bridge, because you know that's going to happen. Registered nurses at HCA's Regional Medical Center in San Jose, California, staged a rally yesterday to demand that HCA maintain life-saving trauma, stroke, and heart attack services at the facility. Now, HCA, based in Nashville, announced earlier this year it intended to close the services coming in August. Got a comment here from Martha Marrero, who is a registered nurse in the emergency department. Martha says, we know that closing down our trauma and stroke centers and eliminating services for those who are experiencing life-threatening heart attacks will cost lives. It is obscene that someone sitting in Nashville who works for a corporation making billions of dollars each year is looking at a ledger and deciding that these vital services in my community should close. The nurses in the community are demanding that these services be maintained because, she said, we know it could be any one of us, our patients or our family members who could suffer the drastic or potentially fatal consequences of these proposed closures. Now, Regional is one of two trauma centers in San Jose and receives patients from Southern Santa Clara County as well as San Benito and Santa Cruz counties. Santa Clara Valley Medical Center, well, they're about an 8-mile drive from Regional. Now, according to Google Maps, that drive can take up to 22 minutes depending on time and traffic, which is vital time that patients could be receiving and not traveling. On top of that, Santa Clara is not equipped to handle a 65% surge in trauma patients. That's what's going to happen should Regional close down. If you go back 5 years in 2019, Regional treated more than 2,400 trauma patients, and Santa Clara treated more than 3,700. If they absorb those patients, that would mean the 65% increase in trauma patients. The data shows that more than 61% of the patients treated in Regional's emergency room identify as Latina. Santa Clara County public health officials have already determined that the Latina community is facing significant health inequities in the county, both in access to insurance and primary care, and they note that the community continues to face higher rates of obesity, diabetes, and COVID-related deaths than others. By the way, getting back to HCA, largest health system in the country, $5.2 billion in profits last year, and they on a regular basis shut down vital health services at hospitals because profit is number one. Their CEO clocks in at number 58 on the Bloomberg list of the world's richest people. What a sad situation. So sad. You want to get some more information, go to National Nurses United. All right, quick break. When we come back, Bill Samuel on behalf of the AFL-CIO.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Attention members of the Heat and Frost Insulators Union who are interested in traveling. Central Ohio has more construction projects on the books than anywhere in the U.S. Mega projects, large and medium-sized jobs are creating more work than our local 50 brothers and sisters can handle. Projects like Intel, the Honda LG battery plant, and multiple data centers for Facebook, Google, and Amazon offer union wages, overtime, and exciting incentives. Local 50 is seeking union travelers to meet the needs of its signatory contractors who can put you to work immediately. If you're a member in good standing and interested in the work opportunities in Central Ohio, visit insulators50.com/AWF travel. For more information. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, where you can find more at teamster.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. You can find more at cwa-union.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
This segment of the show is brought to you by the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. For more information, please visit bmwe.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Iron Workers. You can find more at ironworkers.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency. ULAgency.org is a website. Let's go to line number one. Welcome one of our longtime regulars here, Mr. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. National website, AFL-CIO.org. In the last couple of months, we've been talking about, well, next week, government's going to shut down. Well, next week, there's going to be a government shutdown. I guess we're okay now. We averted, what is it, the fourth shutdown threat. So, Bill, what's the next deadline? That's my question for you.
Right. The next deadline is September 30th. That's when the official end of this fiscal year, FY fiscal year 24. And you're right. We blew past four deadlines because the last fiscal year ended September 30, 2023, and there was no approved budget. And so we were existing on what they call continuing appropriations resolutions. Basically, you're funding the government at the same level. You just kind of kick the can down the road until you can pass a new bill. If you don't pass one of those, the government shuts down. So we got to the edge four times because the continuing resolutions have end dates. The first one was in November, then there was one in January, then one in March, and then finally one, and then another one at the end of March. And they finally agreed on a package of bills to fund the government through the end of the fiscal year, so we don't need any, you know, month-long CRs, continuing resolutions. But we're halfway through the fiscal year. You know, it's about to be April, so that's 6 months into the FY24. Interestingly, what they agreed to, what Congress agreed to, they could have agreed to back in September. It was basically a kind of a status quo budget. No big cuts that the Republicans demanded, no policy changes that the Republicans demanded. The Republicans essentially caved. And I think they would even, many of them would admit that. This is why Marjorie Taylor Greene is calling for the new speaker's ouster, because, you know, the leadership is being accused by the Freedom Caucus, the right wing, of giving in to Democrats. It's probably true. The Democrats outmaneuvered them four times, and now there's now the government will stay open at least through the end of this fiscal year, September 30, and then we'll be right back with the possibility of another shutdown.
So, Bill, after all these shenanigans here, I know a couple members of the Republican Party have left because they're totally frustrated with what's going on. So what's the margin for Speaker Johnson right now, Bill?
Well, he's got a two-vote margin. More than a couple have left. Three or four have left in the middle of the term. You know, it's one thing to say you're not going to run again, but several, I think four, maybe five, Kevin McCarthy being among them, Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, Ken Buck from Colorado, these are all Republicans. They're leaving in the middle of the session and leaving their party and the new speaker kind of high and dry because as their numbers decline, Democrats are staying where they were. The margin is now two votes. I believe in a week or so, with a final Republican retirement, it's going to be one vote. And, you know, basically you can't run an organization when you've got a one-vote cushion, you know, out of 435, assuming Democrats stay united. So what that means is this Congress is essentially flatlining. I mean, I hate to use that term. From now until the end of the session, which will be, you know, election day, it'll go on in a lame duck through the end of the year, but they're just not going to do very much. They will do what is absolutely necessary and where they can get a bipartisan agreement, and so far they've gotten, you know, bipartisan agreement in very few cases. I think one of the ones coming up, they're going to try to get support for this Ukraine funding bill. Mm-hmm. They may pass a bill reauthorizing the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA needs to be reauthorized by the Congress. Not much else is going to happen over the next 5 to 6 months.
That's really sad. And the polling shows that people are really frustrated with this Congress because nothing is getting done. Do they understand that? I mean, you've been working the Hill for a long time right now, and it is kind of a bubble there. I think they're in their own world. But there's a lot of frustration among Americans right now because of what we're talking about. But what are you hearing on your side?
Well, I think, you know, that's why members are leaving in the middle of the session. They're getting other opportunities. One is, you know, one is taking over a state university. Another one is taking over a museum. It's, you know, there's just different opportunities that members see where they can actually get something done, where if they stayed on Capitol Hill, they're getting nothing done. It's a lot of frustration. They do see the public being unhappy, and so then they start to criticize their own institution. That makes it worse. And then they go after their leadership. This, you know, this will be the second attempt to remove a speaker if Marjorie Taylor Greene pulls the trigger. That's never happened before, by the way, until this Congress, when Kevin McCarthy was tossed out. Remember, it took him 15 votes to become Speaker. Then he was tossed out, and then it took five candidates on the Republican side before they found a new Speaker. And now there's a challenge to the current Speaker, Mike Johnson. So this is a totally new environment on Capitol Hill, and it's very discouraging. The public sees that they've lost faith in Congress, rightly so, and members of Congress themselves are heading for the exit. And hopefully, you know, a new election will bring in a new Congress, and things will begin to turn around. And we can keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, I hear you. If you don't mind, I'd like to talk budget, because a couple of weeks ago, President Biden gave his proposed federal budget for fiscal year 2025, which actually starts in the fall, October 1. And presidents have done this. It seems to be largely ignored when they come up with the budget, and you know, he's talking about cutting prescription drug prices, increasing taxes on corporations. Maybe you could go through it. One thing that caught my attention was more money for OSHA. You and I have talked about this, and also the National Labor Relations Board. So my question, maybe you could get into some of the nitty-gritty, but the other part of this is this kind of dead on arrival right now because it's an election year?
It is largely symbolic. I mean, it's an expression of what the president would do were he given another term and had a Congress that would back him up. You know, right now the Republican Congress takes a Democratic president's budget and tosses it in the trash can. Now, they're at a stalemate, as I said. We're funding the government basically at a level, you know, that really goes back to when the Democrats were in charge of the House, which was before the last midterm election, so we're just sort of coasting along. And by the way, you know, you understand that really means a cut because of inflation and growth in population and various workload increases. If you're not increasing budgets to keep up with that, you're really cutting programs. So the National Labor Relations Board, for example, they need a big increase because of the increase in union elections, unfair labor practices, all the labor agitation, and energy we've seen we need to have the cop on the beat. Basically, we need more cops on the beat at the NLRB, and we're not getting them. But the president is asking for that. As you said, he's asking for an increase in the National Labor Relations Board budget, OSHA, mine safety, wage and hour, you know, all kinds of domestic programs that help working families. I don't know that he'll get them unless the Democrats take back the Congress, and then they will be more likely to pass his budget. So it's a good document as an expression of his values, of his sort of what his approach would be if he were given another term and a majority in Congress. So we take it seriously, but it's not going to we're not going to see it enacted by this Congress until after the election.
And that budget has no cuts, zero cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Now, on the other side, the GOP came out, and I love the name of their document. It's titled Fiscal Sanity to Save America, okay?
they're good at titles, not so good at governing.
Okay. And, well, first and foremost, they want to raise the age for Social Security, cut benefits, and also put, I guess, a voucher. I've heard this so many times over the years. Put Medicare on a voucher system. So, from what I gather, you would get X amount of money. When that money runs out, you're out of luck, right?
Yeah, and I think Republicans, the closer they get to November, the more they're going to be running away from this budget. You know, cutting Social Security has, you know, for as long as I've been in Washington, has been called the third rail of politics. You don't touch it, or you're a goner. And so every time Republicans propose privatization, cutbacks, raising the retirement age, which they're doing, they get burned. And then in the, you know, as they get closer to the to election day, they begin to deny that they ever supported it. But it's in writing. You know, as you said, the budget has been released. And Democrats are going to run against it. And they'll be using their own budget, the president's budget, as an expression of what they would do if they were given control in the House. The Senate Democrats are marginally in control. They've got 51-49, so that's not much. But the Republican budget is true to form, frankly, I don't know how they can defend it. And we'll see, in November, whether it proves to be as unpopular as I think it will.
Bill, I have to ask you, I want to bring up John Larson. He's a representative out of Connecticut. I assume you know him. He's got an idea to extend the life of Social Security to 2066. What do you know about that? It's kind of fascinating because right now, I think in the next decade, we might see some cuts to Social Security. Is that right?
Well, Social Security solvency is, there's always a prediction about how solvent and for how long Social Security benefits can be paid at the current rate. They've never been cut. These predictions have never come true, mostly because they underestimate the growth in the economy and wages. So obviously Social Security is paid for out of our payroll taxes. And these deadlines, we get to them and then Social Security turns out to be okay. I think that'll be the case in 2035. John Larson's idea is to really bolster the program and increase benefits, not just put off the day when it may become insolvent, which again I don't think is going to happen, but actually increase benefits for low-income workers. He would do that by raising the cap on payroll deductions. Right now, you stop paying Social Security payroll tax at a certain level, and it's well over $100,000, but it does cap at, I don't know if it's 120. I can't remember what it is this year.
168,000.
Okay, 168. Yeah. It changes every year. It goes up. In any case, if you're Bill Gates or Elon Musk, you stop paying Social Security taxes with your first paycheck, because your first paycheck is probably in excess of $168,000. If you're making, if you're a billionaire. So what John Larson would say is, if you make over $400,000, you would your Social Security payroll tax would kick back in. So between $168,000 and $400,000, which is considered, it's upper class, but it's not the super wealthy, you wouldn't see an increase in Social Security taxes. Remember, Joe Biden has said he's not going to raise taxes on anybody earning under $400,000 a year. So what John Larson would do is kick in the Social Security payroll tax again for those making $400,000 and above. That would raise quite a bit of money, take care of any concern about Social Security solvency in the long run, and allow the government to increase benefits for low-income and part-time workers who retire without much to live on. So it's a good idea. The AFL-CIO supports it. We have for many years. We'll see. Again, with a Republican Congress, it's not likely to see the light of day.
Yeah, it is a good idea, though, no doubt. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. We'll continue with him, AFLCIO.org. Later in the show, we're going to go to the state of Massachusetts, check in with LIUNA Local 596. Chelsea Fenton will be joining us later in the show, and how she rose up the union ranks at 596. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The Iron Workers Great Lakes District Council, consisting of 8 iron worker local unions in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. We build the skylines and bridges along the Great Lakes. With more work than ever before, the Great Lakes District Council is actively searching out the next great iron worker. Whether it's building the next Intel plant or constructing a bridge to safely connect our great cities along the lake. So join the Iron Workers Great Lakes District Council today. Find out how and learn more about the council by visiting iwdistrictcouncil.com. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. You can find more at ifpte.org.
A great union requires a reliable election system. Survey and Ballot Systems is a trusted election partner with more than 30 years of expertise in managing union elections. By partnering with SBS, your union can ensure it gets an auditable process and a high level of customer service. SBS is here to help you conduct your union vote securely, transparently, and with trust building always in mind. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Founded in 1887, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters represents the employees responsible for tirelessly constructing and maintaining the national rail system in America. For more than a century, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees has proven they have what it takes to protect its members and meet the ever-changing challenges of the rail industry. Today, the BMWED continues to fight for job security, fair wages, better benefits, and safer, more modern work environments. For more information, please visit BMWE.org. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Steelworkers. You can find more at USW.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
This portion of the show brought to you by the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers. For more information, please visit bacweb.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on at least five platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. When you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so please keep them coming. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go back to Washington and rejoin Mr. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. Kind of quiet in Washington. We got a recess here because of the Easter holiday. But I have to talk to you about Virginia Fox. Man, I keep getting emails from this. Education and Workforce Committee. They don't like the word union, so it's now workforce. That happened a couple of times when the Republicans took over. But I saw this story, and I figured I got to pick your brain on this. Virginia Fox, who does not like unions, she's out of North Carolina. She sent letters to the presidents of 12 unions, and she's concerned about fraud and corruption. Bill, I know you have dealt with her over the years. What the heck is going on here?
Well, this is an old saw. Unions are, they're democratically run institutions, democratically held elections for leadership. But there are cases of corruption and financial misdeeds, like in any organization. Certainly corporate America wouldn't be strangers to that. But the interesting thing about what Virginia Fox is alleging, that the unions have been guilty of all these financial crimes and fraud, the unions themselves uncover these instances. You know, there's thousands of union locals, the international unions, the state bodies, the area labor councils. I mean, there's thousands of these institutions, mostly with, part-time bookkeepers. Unions don't, except at the international level, they don't have full-time, financial management. So, and there are obviously, and when you're talking about thousands of union entities, that there are going to be financial crimes committed, and the unions themselves uncover them by and large and turn them over to local authorities or the Justice Department, whoever, and then the cases are handled by officials in the government. What mm-hmm. Virginia Fox is alleging is that somehow the unions are looking the other way. Again, what she ignores is that the unions uncover these instances and turn them over. The government very rarely finds them themselves. So this is something Republicans like to do. They kind of confuse the issue. And nobody's justifying, by the way, the crimes. And in fact, what all the letter says to these 12 unions is explain what your internal management systems are to uncover these instances. You know, how do you guard against them? What do you do when you find them? And the unions are going to step up and explain their constitutions, the oversight they have, and how these things get handled. And so I think this is kind of a non-story, but, you know, she's got this big headline about financial fraud and embezzlement and jail terms and all that, as if the unions are just kind of running around, and it's the Wild Wild West. In fact, this is something that unions handle, and handle pretty well by and large. In fact, you know, unions trustee locals when they find these situations occurring, and they turn over their books, and they, prosecutors take these cases, and it's all pretty routine. It's not a good thing, obviously, but this is human nature, I guess. So she's trying to make a big deal about it. I don't think it's a big deal, and I think this whole story is going to kind of go away as soon as the unions respond to her letters.
I see she's got your old union on the list here, the mine workers union.
I'm sure she does. She's got most of the, I mean, these are all big unions, carpenters, plumbers, Teamsters, even SEIU. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of unions. But again, we're talking thousands of local unions with mostly part-time leadership. Again, not excusing it, but you know, this is not unusual that, and, you know, when she's talking about a few dozen instances, when you look at the size of the number of entities that she's that she's investigating, it's probably not a bad record.
Yeah, yeah. So, in your opinion, then, I mean, this is not surprising for what's going on here. I mean, because this
is Virginia Fox trying to get a headline. Although interestingly, this didn't make much news. I don't know. They put out a press release. I don't know. I think sort of the labor press covered it for a day. And again, the unions are going to respond. They're going to. I think they're acting. They act responsibly, and they're going to respond to this inquiry. And they're going to let the chair know what they do to root out and try to prevent as best they can these kind of crimes from happening.
Amazing, just amazing. All right, just another day in Washington. Unbelievable. Right. Well, you hang in there, my friend. I know you got your hands full. Get some rest here, and we'll talk to you next month. Okay.
Great. Look forward to it. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break here. Chelsea Fenton is the executive board recording secretary, a labor steward, and a journeyman at Liuna Local 596. She's got an interesting story to tell, and she's going to tell that story next. Don't go away.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes Liuna to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Auto Workers. Find more at UAW.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans. And we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers. And we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, where you could find more at teamster.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Heat and Frost Insulators Labor Management Cooperative Trust. Find out more at insulators.org/LMCT.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
America's Workforce is presented by the Laborers International Union of North America. Feel the power right now at liuna.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation. Let's go to the state of Massachusetts right now. Actually, it's Holyoke, Massachusetts. Is that right? Is that where you are, Chelsea Fenton, Holyoke, Massachusetts?
My local is out of Holyoke, Mass, 596, but I live a little bit away from it.
Okay. Laborslocal596.org is a website, and Chelsea's got a really interesting story to tell on how she got involved in LIUNA Local 596. But before we get into that, how many people in the local, and how we doing in Local 596 right now, Chelsea?
We actually have about 597 of us.
597 and 596.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got 597 of us.
I love it. Okay, cool. And I can't believe how many locals there are in the district council. I was looking at your map, and there's 20 locals, 20 yeah. LIUNA locals in the state of Massachusetts. That's union strong. There's no question about that. So you became a laborer going back, it was about a dozen years ago, and you were telling me your dad, well, you come from a union family. Your dad's an operating engineer. Is that right?
He is. I was actually working three jobs during the day and going to school full time at night at a community college. And I just was not making a lot of money. And I was in a really bad place in my life. I was in and out of my parents' house. And my dad came to me and with a business card for my old business agent, Tom Andrews. And he, asked me I'd like to do construction like he did. And I said, well, does it pay good? And he said, yeah. Said, well, sign me up. And I went down to the local. I applied the first time. They denied me. I was pretty determined. So I went down a second time, did the interview, all that. They denied me a second time. And then I was kind of at this point. I was like, no, you know what? You're going to give me this job. I need this career with good benefits, and I went down to the union hall the next time the applications went. This time I had a birthday already. I had turned 19, and I went to the business agent. I harassed the guy, and I waited for him to show up to the local, and I said, you know what? You're going to give me this job because I'm going to work circles around these guys. And he's like, okay, all right, well, all right. Well, then I got an acceptance letter, and it's just kind of, the rest is kind of history.
Oh, boy. A little sassy attitude there, and you finally got it. I like that.
I finally got it.
Did they tell you why they denied you? Well, I'm just wondering, was it because you're a woman or because they didn't like your attitude or what?
They said I was timid. It was actually like my first adult like interview. I had worked like odd jobs, like minimum wage, waitressing, bartending, cooking at Friendly's, that kind of stuff. Like, so I like walked in there and I wasn't going to talk like a truck driver. I wasn't going to talk like a construction worker like I am now, because since I was an 18-year-old young woman. So I just, I wanted the job. I didn't really know what to expect. And, so basically, yeah, they just thought I was really timid, and just because I was polite, I guess. And but no, I actually, Tommy Andrew is a very good friend of mine now. He's our secretary treasurer. He was my business agent for a long time, and now he was the first person that asked me to become a labor steward. So I became a labor steward at 25. Then I got on our executive board, and now I, about 2 years ago, I was elected to become the recording secretary of my executive board. So.
Well, congratulations. It's often been said third time is a charm, and it obviously worked for you. And your persistence certainly paid off on that one. So when you started the job, take me back to that time. What were you working on when you became a laborer?
Asphalt. My first job ever was asphalt. I was working for a paving company. I thought I was absolutely going to die because it was, one, hot, and two, you shovel so much working on a berm and curb crew. And it was just, I had no idea what to expect. Nobody told me what to wear or like what boots to buy or anything like that. I mean, and I didn't meet any other women for actually a pretty long time until I got onto a building and site project. So it was definitely interesting, but I worked really hard that summer. I made a lot of money.
Well, Chelsea, you answered my next question here. I was going to ask you if there were other women there, but how were you treated by the other guys on the job? You indicated it was pretty hot. It was a rough day for you, but what about your treatment on the job?
It wasn't that. I actually got very lucky. The first foreman that I ever had was actually, his first operator was my dad back in the day when he started. So he saw my last name, and he's like, he didn't say anything to anybody else, but he asked me if that was my dad, and I said, yeah. He's an operator, though, like, so I want to make my own name. And he just, you know, after the week was done, he said, kid, you can work on my crew any day. He was impressed. I worked really hard. I showed up. I asked a lot of questions, and it just kind of, it went really well my first summer.
Gotcha. So are you in the field anymore, or are you spending all your time with the union now?
I am still currently in the field. I actually had time to talk to you guys today because I'm going into work late and bringing my daughter to a doctor's appointment. Then I got to go check on my site. I'm the labor steward over at a big area college, so I'm going to be there a while.
Okay, good. And the work is pretty good over there at 596?
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of work. And we actually just, my business agent, Colton Andrews, just actually negotiated another project labor agreement. We got a lot of project labor agreements around here, a lot of union work with the colleges. And we're going to have, at the end of the year, when all is said and done, we're going to have over $700 million in project labor agreements in our side of the state.
Boy, that's what we want. More project labor agreements, definitely. Okay, let's talk about women in construction. I understand that you helped found a grassroots network for women in construction called Western Mass Tradeswomen. Talk to me about that. Sounds kind of interesting.
Years ago, we all kind of met each other on a building and site project, and we all connected. We all went to this bar after work and had some beers and started talking, like, what's going on in your local, what's going on in my local, et cetera, like, what works, what's not working, what can we do? And we basically just started helping the different pre-apprenticeships, like Community Works and Building Pathways in our side of the state, to recruit more women. And we kind of saw, we can help out. We can volunteer our time to help our respective locals get more women into the trades. Because, I mean, in all honesty, it's a really great opportunity. Women just don't know about it. So we do this on our own time. We have our union's kind of blessing to basically, we're not sponsored by anybody. We're self-paid. We pay for everything ourselves. And we just volunteer our time. Connect women with tradeswomen in the field. Anybody that has any questions, anybody that wants to know how to apply, you know, to the laborers, the operating engineers, or the pipe fitters and plumbers, the electricians. So basically we do a lot of volunteer work. We do a couple of different Habitat Humanity Days a year. Last year we raised money for cancer. We did a cancer walk. And then, we do a lot of recruitment for our locals. We take time off and we'll go do career fairs. We have the Mass Girls and Trades Conference. So it's just basically a bunch of our tradeswomen that have grown up in the trades last decade. A lot of us are in our, late 20s, early 30s. Some of us are a little bit older. And basically we just kind of took it upon ourselves because there's not enough women in each of our locals for us to, like, have our own women's committee. A couple of us do. But, like, there's just, there's need for us to kind of work together and network and, just try to support the building trades any way we can.
Chelsea, I've been hearing there are a lot of women, people of color getting involved in the trades. But when it comes to women, there's a problem with retention. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues is child care. And, you know, you got to get up early in the morning, and that's difficult, or get kids to school. Well, there's a lot of single moms. How are we navigating through that right now, especially in 596?
Well, so there is a couple of women in my local that have had children. I have a six-year-old daughter. Basically, we got to be honest with women. These are our working hours, right? These are the pros and the cons, and you have to have a lot of support, right? Like out here in Western Mass, there's not a lot of early morning childcare, right? So in Boston, there is a pilot program called Care That Works, and it matches construction workers, tradeswomen, with early childcare facilities and daycare options in the eastern part of the state. We haven't gotten there in the western part of the state, but like with Western Mass tradeswomen, building pathways, community works, if somebody has a problem and they're like, hey, I can't get to this job site, you know, this early, we try to all kind of chip in and help with accommodations. Like if we know a contractor, right, that they're working for, hey, like this, you know, this mom has got to make up some time, or, you know, let's see if we can get some women, you know, somebody that stays home, you know, another members, a lot of our union brothers' wives stay home. And they'll watch different people's, you know, children early morning. There's not a solution yet. It's basically like, you've got to know that these are the hours, right? We can't change those hours, but we can try to accommodate and make up time, or kind of, you know, give resources to people to find childcare that does open early enough.
That's good to hear. Well, at least it's moving in the right direction. Chelsea, we got a couple of minutes left here, and I know you want to talk about social media and how the trades can use it to recruit a more diverse workforce. And I see you've got a lot of followers on TikTok and Instagram. By the way, Chelsea Fenton, you could check her out at That Union Labor. I like that. That Union Labor. Has it been working pretty well for you since you've been kind of mobilizing this effort?
It actually has. I kind of realized a couple of years ago, I kind of saw a social media post by on Facebook from a woman that was bending conduit. And there was all these comments from women that were like, how do I do that? Where do you find this career? Like, how do you apply? And a light bulb went off in my head, like, oh, well, I could do that for the laborers and, you know, and women in trades. And so, I mean, I started with zero followers. I've got 16,000 followers on TikTok, and my most viewed video is like 960,000 views. So it's like,
wow.
The trades can use this as a free marketing tool, right? It's free. Everybody can use it. And you can, it's, the algorithm is so much different than like Facebook or different forms of social media, that you can push your content to different demographics. And 70% of my followers are all women. So
that's awesome.
You know, I go out of my way. Any woman that wants to find an apprenticeship in their area, they can message me. I typically, like, not a lot of women that have no idea what construction is, they don't know what to look for, right? They don't know to Google the Laborers International Union of North America, or, you know, the International Union of Operating Engineers. They don't know what that even is. Right. So if I could just help somebody there, you know, they can just shoot me a message. Hey, I'm interested in the trades. And I ask them, like, you know, do you want to, what trade you're interested in? It's going to be very different if you're in a blue versus a red state. You know, it's all demographics. So it's doable. And the trades just kind of need to kind of monetize on it. It's a free tool that we can use.
You got it. Well, let's drive more people to you. Your Twitter handle I'm reading here is That Union Labor. And then you could find Chelsea on TikTok and Instagram at That Union Laborer. Okay. That Union Laborer. All right. And the website for 596, once again, is laborslocal596.org. Chelsea, thank you so much. I'm going to let you go back to work. Let's talk down the road. Okay.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
You got it. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the National Labor Office of Blue Cross and Blue Shield and the Communication Workers of America. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.